The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So what I'd like to do this evening is read you some poetry from the ancient Buddhist world. And it's presented, and it's likely that it's poetry written by the bhikkhunis, the nuns, the ancient nuns who were disciples of the Buddha. And what some people don't realize is that those of you who know a little bit about the ancient scriptures of Buddhism that preserve the teachings of the Buddha, people often talk about them as the discourses of the Buddha. In fact, this very big book here, you can see here, it's called The Connected Discourses of the Buddha, in big letters. And there's another one called The Middle-Length Discourses of the Buddha. And so you think it's just the Buddha teaching, but in fact, there's a good percentage of these texts that are made up of teachings of people who were his disciples. And some of those teachings are of the female disciples of the Buddha, some of them who were great teachers in their time. And we don't hear about them very much, and we tend to give a lot of priority to the Buddha. But it seems like in the ancient world, they didn't give as much priority to the Buddha as we do in the modern world. People like me, you know, like the Buddha said, right? But actually there's teachings by a number of other people that are considered important enough to preserve in these ancient texts. And so in this very big book called The Connected Discourses, there's a whole chapter of these little suttas that involve involve a nun, a bhikkhuni, who is practicing out alone, meditating, and she is visited by Mara. And Mara is the Buddhist, some people would say the Buddhist personification of everything that could tempt you from being peaceful and concentrated here and now. Some people call Mara kind of like a Buddhist devil-like figure who's seems the primary job of this person, this being, it's kind of like a god-like being, is to prevent people from getting enlightened. And because Mara is kind of like the ruler of the world of sensual pleasures, everything to do with sensual pleasures. And the last thing Mara wants to do is to lose someone from his control. So what this means is that if it should happen someday that you find yourself a little bit under the sway of sensual pleasures and desires, at that moment you have been caught in Mara's snare, Mara's net. And so some people, when they feel themselves being caught by the temptations and sensual desires, sensual pleasures, and the ancient meaning of that, was pretty much anything in the, any material desires in the world whatsoever. I mean, it didn't just mean sex or food or something like that, but it meant, having nice clothes or nice houses or having lots of cows. Which nowadays it's having lots of cars maybe, but back then there was the cows were important, the cattle. So someone who's liberated is not caught anymore in the world of the material world, not caught in the world of sensual desires and addictions, and so is no longer caught by Mara. So these stories have to do with these nuns are meditating and Mara comes to visit them. So here's one of them. So in the morning, the bhikkhuni Soma, dressed and taking bowl and robe, entered town for alms. When she had walked for alms and had returned to her from her alms round, after her meal, she went into a grove of trees for the day's meditation. Having plunged into the grove, she sat down at the foot of a tree for the day's meditation. Then, Mara, the evil one, desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in the nun Soma, desiring to make her fall away from concentration, approached her and addressed her in verse. That state, so hard to achieve, which is to be attained by the seers. So that state of, what they're referring to here is a state of realization, state of becoming enlightened, which is attained by the seers, by the sages, can't be attained by a woman with her two-fingered wisdom. So this is not, unfortunately, not a new kind of idea that exists in the world, that certain attainments are not available to women, only to men. So here we have it in the ancient world as well. And this is Mara saying it. And if you understand Mara to be the personification of inner psychological forces, you can well imagine that a person can internalize these ideas as well. We can often internalize the prejudice and that our society has. But then it occurred to the nun Soma, now who is this that recited the verse? A human being or a non-human being? Then it occurred to her, this is Mara, the evil one, who has recited the verse desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in me, desiring me to fall away from concentration. This is one of Mara's greatest fears, is someone gets concentrated. Because if you get really concentrated still in the mind, then you might get enlightened. So cut it out. Then the Bhikkhuni Soma, having understood this, said, replied to him in verse, what does womanhood matter at all when the mind is well concentrated? When knowledge flows on steadily, as one sees correctly into Dhamma, one to whom it might occur, I am a woman, or I am a man, or I'm anything at all, is fit for Mara to address. Then Mara the evil one, realizing the Bhikkhuni Soma knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared right there. So it's a little bit interesting statement, and a little bit could be a little controversial, her reply. But what she says is that in a state of concentration, it doesn't apply whether you're a man or a woman or anything else. A state of concentration is a state where the mind is not involved in its normal conceptualization of things. It's not referencing, a person is not referencing themselves. Because to reference themselves, to have an identity, to have an idea of an identity, to have concepts of an identity, to operate by the identities that we have, comparing ourselves to others, living up to some ideals, not living up to ideals, all these ideas that tend to churn away in our mind, when we get quiet and still in meditation, those ideas fall away. And it's a very, it can be a very peaceful place, and it's quite a powerful thing to learn that one doesn't have to always be operating under the normal reference points that our society expects of us or has taught us. And so the mind gets quiet and things fall away. And some people find this a tremendous relief because they have messages that our society has taken in, all kinds of messages, prejudice and hate and desires of what we should be and shouldn't be and who we are and who we aren't. That our society kind of just, you know, it's just rampant and painful sometimes. And some people find it a revelation to realize that they are just that, that they are concepts and ideas, sometimes internalized, that live in our minds, in our thoughts and ideas that we go on, and that there is an alternative to them, and the alternative is to stop doing it, to stop seeing ourselves through the filter of all these ideas that we have, and discover a capacity for peace, well-being, a sense of wholeness, a sense of being just fine as we are, independent of those conceptualizations. So this nun is a person who has attained this and knows this. And so she says, you know, what is, you know, she's challenged for being a woman with two-fingered wisdom, which I don't know what that means, but it can't be good. Otherwise, Mara wouldn't have said it. And here's this woman who stands up to this message from Mara or from her society, who knows, and says, you know, what does it matter for someone who's concentrated? I'm not going to get hooked by that. And in fact, she goes on to say that a person who lives, I would probably say, attached to this idea of being a man or a woman or anything else, is set up to be challenged. If you have to hold on to identity and someone comes along and challenges it, most people then would react to it and defend themselves or run away or attack or do something. But she doesn't play the game. And this idea of not playing the game is very powerful. She realizes there's an alternative to always get involved. And in this case, Mara realizes that he's been seen and he goes away. Sometimes, if these things are internalized, if we see clearly what our mind is doing, see the beliefs that are coming up in the mind, the identities we're trying to live by, how we're trying to measure ourselves, if we can see it clearly enough with a quiet mind, these things still happen, but we see it for what it is. We say, oh, that's an idea. So some people find it very powerful to say that's Mara, because it kind of makes a kind of separation. Say, I don't believe that. I'm not going to go there. This is not me. And this is not something that's worthwhile picking up. And just let it be. So I kind of like this verse. It's kind of a strong statement. Some people find that this kind of statement that Buddhists will often make, that or say it this way. So in the 1970s and 1980s, and when I was in the Buddhist world, that was the beginning of when feminism came into American Buddhism. There wasn't much going on before that. And one of the responses of men was women were making too much of this, because in the Dharma there are no men and women. So you know, don't talk about it. Just continue the way things are, please. It was kind of the message. And so sometimes if you say there are no men, no women, no anything, and now there's other, we recognize and welcome all kinds of genders now that are different than just men and women. And, you know, so if we begin, you know, we need to recognize the differences we have. We don't want to just kind of say they don't exist and say, well, you know, when you're concentrated and the mind is empty and you see everything is empty, the differences don't matter anymore. That can lead to kind of oppression as well, because we need to respect everyone for what they are and see them directly. But what she says in this verse, she says, for someone who's concentrated. So there is a time to be able to put this to rest and not see the world through the filter of the ideas. And there's a time to pick up the ideas. And the idea is a time to see clearly, you know, that there are differences and distinctions, and to respect and honor some of them and for who they are and who people are, and not to kind of pretend that we're, you know, to say that we're all equal or all the same has a profound truth, and it also overlooks all the wonderful differences we have as well. So how do we play both? How do we engage in the world in both? And what I've discovered is that meditation practice is a great teacher for how to do both, because meditation practice goes well, the mind gets quieter and quieter and learns to see oneself and see the world without any concepts. And it's possible to see another person with a tremendous beauty, appreciation, just to see someone without the filter of ideas. See oneself without the filter of ideas. And that, I think, is very, you know, we can see our common humanity, we can see love, we can see beauty in people. It's really great. But also, that freedom that comes from that quiet mind, or that also then is able to then see the arising of differences and distinctions and relate to them in a freer way and have more choice about how we relate to them, to see which ones are useful and which are not, which should be honored and which should not be, which are harmful and which are not harmful. And so it becomes a possibility to come out of that quiet state and have tremendous respect for what we see and the differences we have as well. At least that's my hope. But without, you know, I don't know of any way as good as deep meditation to help us see, to really, really see what goes on in our mind and deconstruct it. And part of Vipassana practice, the practice we do here, is a practice of deconstruction in part. And that is to begin deconstructing all the constructs we have in the mind. And we have edifices and cathedrals and, you know, skyscrapers in there that we built, you know, our society's built, ideas and everything that we live on. And to be able to kind of dismantle them in that state of deep calm and peace, so we have the experience of being alive without it. And so all the things we have, all the ideas we have, I need to have, or my history, what happened to me, and, you know, what I need to fix and what I need to do, and all kind of fall away, and we see ourselves free. And these verses by the nuns, some of these, as you read them, are expressions of people who have tremendous confidence. And so this Bhikkhuni Soma, who says, you know, what is it to be, you know, what is womanhood to someone who's concentrated? She's standing up against very powerful forces of society and internal sources with tremendous confidence, and say, I'm not going there, I'm free. I think it's nice. So does that make sense? So before I read some more, does anyone want to comment on that, or any protests? Anything about that you'd like to? Yes, if you can wait for the mic.
Hi. So it's not exactly a protest, but it's a question, which is, how do we deconstruct when emotions are flowing through us? Like either someone comes at us with contempt or anger, or you see someone in deep sadness and you're feeling a sadness for them, and yet you're trying to deconstruct what's going on within you simultaneously.
Great question. And first thing that occurs to me is, as an answer to that, is that don't wait to learn how to deconstruct or understand yourself well until the crisis. So you have to kind of prepare the ground. That's why we meditate or practice mindfulness and these things. So it begins understanding how our mind works, and understand what are the concepts we live under, and what is extra, what's not needed, and what is needed. So if someone has contempt for you, it's a terrible thing. And what happens to you inside when that happens? And it might be all kinds of ideas that you're carrying along that strikes that are not necessary, that you're carrying along. And so it gets much heavier and more difficult than it needs to be, because of the history of, you know, of ideas that you've incorporated and you live by, and your experiences in the past. And because you haven't processed that and understand what that is, it all becomes a big mush. And so it's hard then to kind of separate it out that moment. But if you've done the work before and start to see some of the operating principle that goes on, that can help quite a bit. The other thing that can help, and it's another reason why meditation is good, because meditation is not only a deconstruction process, but it's also a well-being process. If you can develop a sense of well-being that's internal and be settled on yourself, then there's a reservoir of some kind of sense of peace or well-being or something, which is a nice alternative to some of the difficult feelings that arise when someone has something like contempt. And so that doesn't mean that it's not difficult, but it's not the only reference point. A person says, "Oh, I have this other reference point. I have some kind of well-being." Or if there is no well-being, what some people find is, by regular training, they have a reference point of staying in their body. Because when there's a very big challenge like that, then we often get caught up in our emotions and thoughts. And you talked about being caught in the emotions. And if you have a strong practice of dropping into your body, then it's less likely for most people that they're going to be swept away into their thoughts. And the thoughts are often what fuels the emotions. Sometimes there's other reasons for it, but, you know, oftentimes. So this idea of preparing the ground and getting ready. And then when it happens, these things, then hopefully you have the self-understanding to know where to pay attention, how to pay attention, how to care for yourself, how to know when this is not the time to stay. Maybe I need to get out of this situation and process it somewhere else. And when it's appropriate to stay there and look the person right in the eye and say, Do you realize what you just did for me? Do you realize what you've done? Do you realize the impact you've had? And sometimes people will, sometimes people will pay attention if you say something like that. Do you realize what you just did? We had a neighbor here at IMC many years ago. We were doing renovation work. And he was a neighbor who was easily disturbed by any sounds at all that came around. So he would come over and be angry regularly about the sounds of the hammering and stuff and all kinds of things. And it was kind of a little bit inappropriate, we felt. So we lived with him for a while and we were patient with him. And then one day he stormed up into my office upstairs and was kind of livid. And I looked at him and I said, when you come up this way, I find it really hard to stand here and talk to you. And boy, did he quiet down quickly. That was all it took. And then he was quieted down. He was ready for like a big something fight. And I said, that's really hard to talk with you. And he kind of calmed down. And then we were able to have a more proper conversation. And then he kind of apologized and he went. So that's a long answer. Is that enough of an answer for now, or do you want to ask some more for you?
I was just going to say, I used to come hear you speak at Stanford when you were a PhD student.
Oh.
I was there for my master's.
Oh.
And a similar question came up, and you said a similar thing, which is turning into
yeah.
that which creates that anxiety or emotion, as opposed to turning away from it
uh-huh.
or running. Just staying with it,
right.
but staying calm with it and allowing it to sort of arise and pass.
Yes, and if you can do that, that's great. And if you have enough self-practice and self-knowledge, then you know when you're able to go towards it and when it's strategic to step away.
Thank you.
Someone else? Right behind you, there.
Hi, Gail. I was wondering if you have an idea or could explain to us what's actually happening in the deconstruction process in the body, like why bringing the awareness or being present is actually like allowing these things to deconstruct?
Uh-huh. That's a good question. The way you worded it, why being in the body in the present moment, oftentimes the mind is not in the present moment. Thinking about the future and the past is part of that construction process of the mind. It's building memories and living in memories and plans, anticipations or fantasies. And so that we would call that constructions of the mind to do all those things. So the more we can be in the present moment, the less those constructions are operating. We're not thinking about the future and the past. And just that makes things for many people much simpler. So that begins to fade away. And quiet down, and we're not caught in the grip of those so much. And then as we begin to relax into the present moment, and part of relaxation is not feeding those thoughts, learning how we get involved in them, how we react to them, and how we stir them up and keep them going. And as we learn not to keep stirring them up, how to let go of the thoughts, then the thinking starts quieting down, the whole system begins quieting down. Then there's a kind of a feedback loop between little bit of calming and relaxing teaches us to relax the mind and thinking even more. As we relax the thinking mind more, the body gets quieter and calmer. And so it kind of supports and so mostly it's a matter of calming down. And the thinking, as the thinking gets calmer and calmer, the thinking doesn't go away. It's not like a switch, you can just push a button and stop. But the thinking gets kind of softer and quieter or weaker or thinner. I like the word thinner. And after a while, the thoughts don't have much authority anymore. In ordinary life, our thoughts can have tremendous authority. We believe every thought; they're like the most real thing going on. It seems so consequential. But as we quiet down, they just become more like clouds and whiffs that go through. And we say, "Oh, it's just a thought," and then we're less involved. And then some of the more complicated ones, start falling away faster and faster. So, for example, you might be really caught up already in the next presidential election, and your constructions are all about thinking about, the candidates and this and that, and who's going to win and who's the good candidate, and horrified by some of them, and you know, whatever, right? And I mean, that's a construction of the mind, you know, politics and democracy, and you know, and as you know, you can't sustain wondering about, you know, questions about the American democratic system. How democratic is it really? And who's running the show? And as your mind gets quieter and calm, it doesn't mean that kind of thinking is wrong. It should be done sometimes, but it's hard to sustain it because it's a lot of work. Am I saying something? I have this problem of going on and on. Is this addressing what you said, or you want to ask again? Or?
Yeah, no, it's great. That's great. Thank you.
Anything more I should say?
I guess if the thoughts are calming down, are the thoughts like an actual energy that's calming down, like physically in your body?
Is that
why it's helpful? Or like why do some things, if you've had this construct that you've believed your whole life, does when you start meditating, it seems to fall away? Like,
Well, sometimes it's because the mind gets quieter and quieter, just in the quiet. And that happens in ordinary life as well. Something can happen that just things that you've been operating for a long time, quite incessantly, some kind of falls away temporarily. And it's not operating, and then you're surprised afterwards. So, you know, some people go, if they can go backpacking sometimes. When I was younger, I used to go backpacking. And some of the things that I didn't question in city life, I just were always there in the background, and my beliefs and how I operated would fall away up in the Sierras. And then I saw, oh, this is really nice. And then I'd go back, and I'd see it come back again. So sometimes just changing our venue and what we do can help some things fall away temporarily. And so same thing with meditation. You sit and meditate, and you get concentrated and still, and certain things can fall away. The real thing that, one of the really important things that works is when we can not just have it fall away, but when we have wisdom about it. And wisdom means we really understand well what's going on. We can see a thought, we can see an idea, we can see it just as an idea, and we can see it as not a useful idea, it's not an idea we have to pick up, or it's a dated idea, it's an old idea that's no longer relevant. Or another piece of wisdom is we see not the idea as being somehow empty or not relevant anymore, but we see that the clinging to it, the holding on to it for dear life, no longer serves us. And it's painful to hold on. And then some people then begin to release the grip they have in those thoughts when they see that, you know, how they're relating to it. So that's part of what the function of mindfulness is, to help us not only get calm, but more importantly to have this wisdom that sees what's really going on. And the more calm we can get, actually the more deeply we can see what's going on. Does that seem okay?
Yep, thank you.
Okay. Over here now.
So you talk about deconstruction to understand who we are, and to an extent we get a sense for what we are not. Who are we?
I understand the question. Unless you want to say more.
No, it's probably a variation of the questions that have already been asked.
And so why is that an interesting question?
Because I'm still struggling with it.
How do you understand your struggle? See, the approach in mindfulness would be not to answer your question, but ask you to be mindful of the struggle. And so if you turn the attention around, not to answer the question out there, but to really feel and be present for the struggle, what happens to you?
I don't know if I've got an answer for that.
Say it a little bit louder, please.
I don't know if I've got the answer for that.
Oh. Maybe the problem has gone away. You know, some problems don't get solved, they just dissolve. And that problem of who are we, is a problem that sometimes is better off just let it dissolve. And the freedom is found there, not in the answer. Someone else? Should I read one more verse, poem, of these nuns? Yeah? Okay, I'll choose one then. There's a few more. This one is by a famous nun named Kisa Gotami. And some of you have probably heard of her, Kisa Gotami. Before she was a nun, Kisa apparently means frail, so frail Gotami. And she was quite poor, grew up quite poor. And then she was married to someone who was of better status in life, had more money, more security. And back then, you know, there were arranged marriages, so she was, arranged marriage was made, and she married this into this family. But she was treated very poorly by the family, by the mother-in-law, and, you know, she was just a very low-status person, and so they kind of treated her that way, and even though she was not married to the son. And then she had a child, and she was a son, which in ancient India is, you know, has a higher status than having a daughter. And so her status in the family went up. And so that was, you know, things weren't better for her then, from having come from poverty and then being somehow all this prejudice in the family, she became better. So that's kind of the background of her story, that at some point her son died. And she was completely distraught. And, you know, I think most parents would be distraught at the death of their child, but it was much more complicated for her because her whole security, well-being, her social service, her social network, you know, was the family that had taken her in when she married the son. And her status in the family, well-being, was all kind of measured through having the son, and the son died. So it was not just simply losing her son, but also her security, her place in society was kind of challenged in some very deep way. And so she was distraught, and she refused to believe that the son had died. And she carried her young son, who was dead, around to all the villagers, asking someone for medicine to cure him, to help him. And she was apparently kind of deranged or, you know, quite crazed at some point, which maybe you can understand that can happen. And so eventually someone said to her, oh, well, you should go see the Buddha. He probably has medicine for you. So she went to the Buddha, carrying, you know, the corpse of her child, and said, you have medicine. And he said, go into town and collect mustard seeds from every house that has not been visited by death, where no one's died in that house. And so she felt, and mustard seeds are a very common spice in India, so pretty much every house had mustard seed. And so so she very hopefully went to town and started knocking on doors. And she went to the first house and said, you know, do you have some mustard seed? And they said, yes. And that was good. Well, has anybody ever died here? Oh, yes. You know, I can't go through the whole list of generations of people. And so, oh, okay. So she goes to the next house. Knocks. Same thing. Next house. Same thing. And slowly it begins to dawn on her that death is something that visits everyone. It's part of life. And at some point then, with that, she could begin accepting the fact, or accepting is probably not the right word, but admitting that her son was dead. And then she went back to the Buddha, and a changed woman, no longer somehow deranged, having accepted or admitted this is what was going on, then she became a nun. And she became, and practiced as a nun, and became one of the enlightened disciples of the Buddha. So a very powerful story, whether it's true or not, we don't know. But so there's this, here's a story of her. So it's the same as, it starts off the same as the other one. She goes and meditates, and when she starts her meditation, Mara comes, and Mara's primary strategy to these nuns is try to frighten them, and to stop them from meditating. And so Mara says this: "Why now, when your son is dead, do you sit alone with tearful face? Having entered the woods all alone, are you on the lookout for a man?" And then she says in reply, she says to herself, "This is Mara, the evil one." So she recognizes who it is. And then she replies to him, "Having gotten over the death of sons, with this, the search for men has ended. I do not sorrow, I do not weep, nor do I fear you, friend. The light everywhere has been destroyed. The mass of darkness has been sundered. Having conquered the army of death, I dwell without defiling taints." Then Mara, the evil one, realizing that nun Kisogotami knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared right there. So, I like it that she calls Mara friend. Isn't that nice? She also refers to him as the evil one, but... nor do I fear you, friend. See, I like these. I like these messages of people who are, not afraid anymore. "I do not sorrow, I do not weep. With this, the search for men has ended." I met a woman many years ago who, she was about 65. She said, "You know, these men are overrated." I always thought I had to have a man in my life to be successful. That was a message I had growing up in my society. And so I was always looking for a man to kind of be my partner and do things with. And now that I'm 65, I realize that that's not necessary to do that. And she was kind of felt free of men. Isn't that great? At least it was great for her. But, again, what are some of the messages, the social messages that we live under? Kiso Gotami lived under the tremendous weight of social messages of prejudice against women and preference for boys and the caste system back then and poverty. And so she knew a lot of this. And so all the connection of what it means to be in relationship, which is often very complicated, even in our modern world, the expectations and the of what's involved in those relationships and what we're getting from them is, so all these layers and layers of what's going on. And so to be able to, again, see those constructions, that's one of the great challenges for those of us who are doing Buddhist practice who, while being in relationships, is begin to do that deconstruction process, begin seeing clearly what are all the things that are going on in our related life, the world of, our connection to friends and partners and the whole idea of relatedness and relationships. There's layers and layers and layers to unpack in order to really start becoming free from the ways we're caught by that and have some of the deep needs that are connected to it. And so Kiso Gotami had to confront something very deep, almost biologically deep in herself, because she had to confront the loss of a child. And so for her to kind of come to a place where she's overcome the death of a son is a beautiful thing, a profound thing. I don't think it's dismissive of that. I've known people who've lost young children and seen them, as a Buddhist teacher, have watched them from the time of tremendous grief and over the months and the years through the practice, kind of coming out to the other end, the other side. It's quite something. One of the most significant stories I like of this regard is there was a woman I met, first time I met her on retreat, sometime in the last year her 14-year-old daughter had committed suicide, she was distraught. She did a month-long retreat that I was teaching, and so I saw her quite regularly. She needed a lot of support, remember sometimes sitting and she was just sobbing in my lap, just sobbing and sobbing. And so, you know, mostly I saw her on retreat. And over the years, she came on retreat. And then at some point, I don't know how many years it took, she'd kind of come out to the other side. And then I was on retreat again. And sometimes on retreats, we have group interviews the first few days. So I was sitting in a group of maybe seven people. Talk about their practice. And she was in that group. And the woman just before her, who spoke first, spoke that her son had just died. I think it was also suicide. But I knew that the next person speaking was this woman who had, you know, gone through it. And so I introduced them right then and there. She, you know what? I think, why don't you stay afterwards and the two of you can talk? Because she knows what she's been through that. Because sometimes it's really helpful to meet someone who's actually gone through it. And you know, I knew her well enough, the first woman, that I knew that was okay to make that connection. So then I didn't see that first woman for another many years. And then she showed up here at IMC one day to do we have here at IMC a chaplaincy training program. And she came to do our chaplaincy program because she wanted to become a grief counselor. So this, you know, this beautiful kind of trajectory. You know, it didn't start off that beautiful, but I mean, here's someone who went and practiced with this deep, deep thing, deep loss, and it's not easy. I can tell you that, but it is possible, and you know, see it through. And so, Kizo Gotami is someone like this, and someone who had learned to become free. And then her freedom was no longer caught in the social messages, social mores, social system that many people are often caught in. And she became free. And so I do not sorrow, I do not weep, nor do I fear you, friend. So, my friends, I wish that you have the experience of sitting in the woods, or the equivalent, your bedrooms, and being visited by some of the forces of Mara. They'll come, I'm sure. And some of them will well up, have their source deep inside of you. And some of them will have their original source from our society, from your family and your religions or whatever. And I hope that when they come, you can with confidence say, I see you. I see you. And say, I have no fear of you. I'm free. I'll just stay here and be unmoved by you, by this, these voices, these messages, these thoughts. This idea of being able to sit there and be unmoved. And then here in this story, every time when Mara is seen, Mara goes away disappointed. And what I love about this is that the person does not invite Mara in for tea. Come, you know. But also doesn't condemn Mara, doesn't chase Mara away and say, go away. All the person does is say, I see you. The tremendous power of seeing what's there. So I hope that all of you can learn this ability to be able to sit still, upright, confident, fearless. And when these powerful messages and powerful emotions come, to be able to see them, I see you. In that seeing, not kind of lose touch with some inner dignity, some inner strength, some inner confidence, fearlessness that I'm sure is waiting inside of each of you to be your strength. Great, thank you.